It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Flint, Michigan made headlines this year because of extremely high lead poisoning rates. Our guest tells us why Flint isn't alone when it comes to lead contamination.
First, the Assembly wrapped up its session last week, and that leaves a lot of proposals on the cutting room floor, including things like a ban on the sale of fetal tissue and a bill that would legalize fantasy sports in the state.
Matt DeFore joins us with the details. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Judith, thanks so much for having me on again.
So last week, as we said, the Assembly wrapped up their session. The Senate is meeting again in March. Do we know why the Assembly ended their session now?
Well, it's an election season, and certainly the Assembly was eager to get back to their home districts so they could get a head start on the upcoming campaign season. But, one thing to note about the timing here is that while the Assembly has said it's done with its official business, it may still come back for any kind of cleanup, although they're not hoping to, they're not planning to, but they're back in their home districts, I guess.
So Assembly Speaker Robin Voss called this the most productive and historic session in recent memory. Would you agree with that assessment?
Well, yeah, he was saying it was one of the most productive and conservative sessions in recent memory. They definitely got a lot of things done. I mean, from a conservative perspective, they passed right to work. They made changes to the campaign finance laws. They got rid of the Government Accountability Board, which was a big thorn in the side of Governor Scott Walker, at least. They've definitely done a lot of things, but there's a lot of things they didn't get done as well as with any session.
And so, as you just alluded to, there were many bills that didn't pass in this session. Let's dig into some of those bills. One was regarding transgender students and with which bathroom they could use. What happened with that bill?
So the as with many of these bills, including the transgender bathroom bill, it apparently just didn't have the support of the Republican caucus. I spoke with Jesse Kramer, who is the Republican lawmaker who proposed that bill. He had a number of proposals that were certainly from a very conservative perspective, priorities, and didn't make it through that one. There was a lot of opposition to it. I know in the committee hearing, there were a lot of questions about how it would work. And I think there were, some school districts were saying, many school districts were saying, have our own policies as the current system. But in the end, it just didn't have the support to pass. But I know that Representative Kramer told me that it is something he wants to bring back in the future for an issue of student privacy, that they want to make sure that students are using the bathroom of their birth gender. So we'll see if that gets some traction in the future.
So certainly one of the more hot button or high emotion topics was the sale of fetal tissue, and there was a bill that would ban the sale of fetal tissue. Why wouldn't that have moved forward?
Well, this is, again, it's another Jesse Kramer bill, and it's another one of importance to the religious conservatives. It got a lot of traction last year during the whole Planned Parenthood video issue, which turned out in the end to maybe not be as big of a scandal as initially thought. But that bill, before there were charges brought against the group that did those videos, there was already opposition to that bill in Wisconsin from a lot of the biotech industry, from healthcare organizations, groups supporting abortion rights. So that bill had a lot of issues in the state, even without the flap about the videos.
There were a couple bills that had to do with carrying firearms. One would have allowed concealed weapons inside university buildings. Another would allow concealed carry on school grounds. What happened to those bills?
Those bills also didn't pass. Those are also Jesse Cramer bills. When I was doing this list, I kind of I felt like we were picking on him because a lot of them were his bills. But we did a profile on him a few weeks ago. He's been just seems to be thwarted in various places. The campus carry and the being able to conceal carry in school grounds, just didn't have the votes in the caucus, the Republican caucus, to make it through. And given that the assembly is now done, those bills won't even really have, even if the Senate wanted to pass them, they wouldn't have a chance necessarily of going all the way because the assembly doesn't plan to meet again.
We're talking with Matt DeFoor, State Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, about bills that were not passed before the end of the State Assembly's current session. One that we highlighted in the intro was a bill that would legalize and regulate fantasy sports. What was at the core of that, and why didn't it go anywhere?
This is an interesting one because this has been a national issue of the fantasy sports industry has been wanting to sort of proactively legalize fantasy sports in various states. As we've seen some states' attorneys general come out against this as a form of gambling. In Wisconsin, it's an interesting issue, too, because we have gaming compacts with the tribes, and so there was some question as to whether this legalizing this in a formal way or regulating it and legalizing it would in some way run afoul of the compacts. They ended up not moving forward with this bill, and we'll see if it comes back in the future. But there may have been some questions among lawmakers as if they did legalize it, would it have put some kind of would it have put those compacts in jeopardy and the millions of dollars in revenue the state gets from the gambling proceeds from the tribes? So it was put out there as the industry has hoped for, but as for now, it's going to just sort of remain the way it is, which is that fantasy sports are not legal, they're not illegal. Our attorney general hasn't said anything about them, but if you want to keep playing fantasy sports, you can. We'll see if that comes back.
So you just mentioned the state's relationship with the tribes, and another big topic was a bill that would have allowed landowners to challenge burial mound designations and be able to excavate and develop areas that are thought to have human remains in burial mounds. That was a big topic of the State of the Tribes address recently that Mick Isham from the Lakota Ray tribe had talked about. What was it that put that bill at least on the back burner?
So, yeah, again, another example where all the speaker boss's office will tell us that it just didn't have enough votes in the caucus. I didn't gain a lot of additional insight into that one other than, it was an issue, like you mentioned, that was brought up in the State of the Tribes. With any number of these bills, there's just a sense that it's, it's an election year, and any bill that's going to cause any kind of undue opposition or contentiousness in the public's eye, as opposed to again, a lot of these bills when they're getting pushed through initially, they're being pushed through because a more limited interest or a landowner interest or some smaller group is interested in them. But if it's causing a bigger stir among the larger public, there may not be as broad of support as is necessary for the past.
So as we mentioned earlier, Matt, the Senate does have another floor session scheduled for March. Some of the bills that were passed in the Assembly could be amended by the Senate. What would happen then?
Right. So there's an example of this is the college affordability package that Governor Walker mentioned he came out as a champion of in his State of the State address. This is things like an income tax deduction for student loans, and various programs to help connect kids with college credits and get sort of technical skills and grants for kids who are already in technical college. These kinds of one of the big themes in this session is that the state just doesn't have that much money. If you look 2 years ago, the legislature going into an election season had $1 billion. To which they were able to use to cut taxes, property and income taxes, a major buy down of the tech college property tax. This time around, the state's fiscal situation is much more tenuous. And so the Fiscal Bureau, their most recent estimate had the state with about $135 million projected in the bank at the end of the fiscal year, which is a year from this upcoming June. And that only, you know, there's a statutory limit, so really there's only about $70 million that they could safely spend. And there's a drunk driving bill that has now passed both houses and is expected to be signed by the governor, which, you know, there's dispute about this, but, you know, could cost tens of millions of dollars per year, maybe even $100 million. So the legislature doesn't really necessarily have the funds to do a lot of these initiatives. And so the Senate has talked about how the college affordability package, which right now is, you know, pegged at about $10 million, you know, they may want to cut that back to $2 million. And if they do, the Assembly would either have to come back and vote for that or not return, and the whole thing would die. So.
And before we let you go, Matt, when is the Assembly scheduled to come back in a regular session?
Oh, the Senate, I believe. Yeah, it's supposed to be in March. I don't have the exact date off the top of my head, but certainly a couple weeks from now, we'll be able to write the story about everything the legislature did do.
Mm-hmm. So. And the Assembly, is it in the fall that they would be back?
Oh, the Assembly. Well, no, they won't be back until after the election. Yeah, this is the end for the Assembly, and then in March will be the end for the Senate until we have a whole new session starting in January.
Matt, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
That was Matt DeFore, State Capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, talking about bills that the State Assembly left behind as they wrapped up their session.
Since news of the Flint water crisis, we've heard a lot on the hazards of lead, especially for children, everything from developmental disabilities to hearing loss to chronic fatigue. Since news of the unsafe water in Flint hit headlines, a lot of other cities have been taking note of lead contamination in their own backyards and found problems as bad, maybe even worse than Flint's, especially in communities with older housing.
One of the most well-known ways to get lead poisoning is through lead paint, which can be found in old houses that haven't been updated since lead paint was outlawed in 1978. But lead has managed to make its way into homes through the water supply as well.
David Jacobs joins us now. He's chief scientist at the National Center for Healthy Housing. He previously worked at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development as director of the Office of Healthy Homes and Lead Hazard Control. He was principal author on Housing and Urban Development's guidelines and the President's Task Force report on childhood lead poisoning in 2000. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Glad to be with you.
Well, a lot of attention on Flint, and a lot of cities are maybe looking around trying to figure out if they have a problem. It seems like part of the problem is, on a national level, we just don't know how bad the lead problem is. Is that right?
Well, we do have some data from the Centers for Disease Control, which is charged with counting the number of children who have been lead poisoned. Their latest estimate is that well over half a million, 535,000 to be exact, children have blood lead levels above their reference value.
But as I understand it, not all states report to the CDC, and the states that do pretty much all have different standards by which they report.
Yes, that's right. And in fact, the funding for the Centers for Disease Control has been slashed in recent years, making it far more difficult for them to properly do their surveillance activities. So you're right, we don't have a great estimate of the actual number of children who are exposed. It's probably much higher than the number I just gave you.
And can you talk about, we alluded to this a bit, how bad lead is, how big a concern this should be for us?
Well, we've known about the problems of lead for, millennia, actually. And so it's not one of those metals your body needs, like iron or zinc. It has no useful value in the body, and in fact causes all sorts of issues with behavior and intelligence declines and many other adverse health outcomes. So that's the bad news. The good news is that we actually do know how to control this problem.
Yeah, and let's get into remediation. We see, as we mentioned, lead coming from paint, often in older houses, and water supplies. Do you have a sense of which is our biggest problem, our biggest worry in the country right now?
Well, they both are. The fact is that housing has been known for a long time to be the major risk factor. But, you know, in a case like Flint or, you know, years ago in other cities, it's like any other disease. If we don't pay attention to how to control the risk factors, then it comes back to haunt us. And the same is true whether it's lead in paint or lead in water. These are both concerns, and we need to take steps to properly control those risks.
This is a problem that's concentrated in certain areas, as I understand it. 60% of Wisconsin's lead poisoned population is in Milwaukee County. That county's had about 442 cases of lead poisoning in 2014. What is it that makes certain cities vulnerable to lead contamination?
Well, actually, I looked up the Milwaukee data myself, and if you look at the number of children who are exposed above the CDC reference value, which is now 5, the actual number is more like 2,800. So this is a huge problem in Milwaukee and elsewhere. And as you alluded to, the primary issue has to do with older housing as well as lead-contaminated or lead drinking water pipes. And those pipes can be managed if the, you know, if the water chemistry is handled properly. And lead hazards in homes can also be managed properly in the near term. But we need to have both a short-term strategy as well as a long-term strategy to make sure that our children are protected.
We're talking about lead contamination in housing, mostly older housing. We have David Jacobs with us, chief scientist at the National Center for Healthy Housing. Let's get into fixing these problems, David. Let's start with our water supply. It seems like there are a couple of approaches. One is anti-corrosive agents in places where you have lead water intakes, lead water lines, or the other option, getting rid of those lead water lines and replacing them. What are the pros and cons of each approach?
Well, obviously, replacing the lead lines is far more expensive, but I think that the cities that have embarked on this have basically adopted a twofold approach. That is, in the near term, let's make sure our water chemistry is right and control the hazards, and then we should also be updating the EPA drinking water lead standard, which hasn't been updated since 1990. It's way out of date and needs to be fixed, or updated, I should say. The second thing is to replace those lead lines. Ultimately, we don't really know where they are. We should know where they are. Some cities have proceeded to do that. For example, when they pave the streets, they also take that opportunity to replace the lead service lines. So I think the most rational approach is to adopt a two-pronged strategy, one dealing with, you know, the immediate risks so that they're controlled, and then we have a long-term strategy to remove the sources of exposure so that they don't ever, you know, threaten our children again.
As you say, this is expensive. Are a lot of communities taking that approach that you're talking about to ultimately get rid of all those lead lines?
No, I'd have to say that's probably the exception, not the rule. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that the nation has not adequately invested in our drinking water treatment systems. So you kind of get what you pay for. If we don't make the investments in our infrastructure, whether it's pipes or the ability of our water treatment plants, or lead paint in housing, for that matter, we will run the risk of poisoning our children. And there's no good reason for that. We should make the investment.
And are we doing enough monitoring, both of our water and of blood lead levels in children?
No. For example, even in Wisconsin, only a fraction of the children are actually screened for lead exposure. Now, of course, that's limited because if the blood leads are high, then in some respects the damage has there has already been done. Mm-hmm. So we need to take further steps to make sure that you know, the children are screened, and we also need to screen their houses as well as the drinking water lines. So why not do a census, for example, to find out where are those lead lines? Where is the lead paint located in a home? Right now, there's no requirement to do such a census to find out where the problem actually is.
And let's get into lead paint and remediation of it. It's concentrated, as I understand, in sometimes older housing, often for lower-income residents, maybe people who can't afford to deal with it properly. Is there some kind of wider effort to help, I don't know, remove, cover lead paint?
Yeah, the technologies to control lead paint hazards is pretty well known. It's been around for decades. However, and you're right to point out that the hazards are greater in low-income communities and communities of color. The main funding source for remediation is the HUD Lead Hazard Control Program, and that program has slowly declined in funding over recent years. So the privately owned low-income housing stock, where the risks are greatest, don't really have adequate resources to address the problem. In the HUD budget, it has declined from when I was there, the peak was $175 million a year. That's now down to, I think it's $110 million. So full funding for that program is on the order of $230 million a year. And happily, I'm pleased to report that some congressmen or congress members seem to be pursuing full funding for that program. It's sad in some ways that a case like Flint is what it takes to get the attention, but perhaps we'll see some progress on that front.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to David Jacobs, Chief Scientist at the National Center for Healthy Housing, Adjunct Associate Professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois at Chicago. He's been talking to us about some of the hazards of lead in older homes.
4 and 3 and 2 and 1, 1.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Veronica Rickert will be back tomorrow.
We're listening to the theme song from Broad City, a show on Comedy Central focusing on the lives of two women in New York City. The show's third season just premiered last week.
The episode sparked a lot of discussion about how we're in the time of the platonic rom-com, or the golden age of female friendship. Our next guest just wrote a piece about female friendships on TV. She says from Lucy and Ethel of I Love Lucy to Abby and Alana of Broad City, the best love stories on TV are between two women in a platonic relationship.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Who is your favorite female twosome, your favorite female friendship on television? What do you think about the idea that the best platonic love stories on TV are between two women friends? Can you think of any shows that fit or go away from that trend? Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Molly Eichel is with us now. She's a contributor for the AV Club and TV writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
So let's lay out your argument. Why do you say that the best love stories on TV are between two female friends?
I remember watching Gilmore Girls, which is kind of one of the great examples of this. When I was a kid, and I was a high schooler, and then into college, and it bothered me that they were pulling apart the central love story between Luke and Lorelai. You know, they had the will they, won't they for years. They finally got together, and then they kept pulling them apart for reasons that really didn't make any sense. And while I was watching this, I noticed that one of the, other than the kind of central relationship between the mother-daughter between Rory and Lorelai, my favorite relationship was between friends on this show, with Suki and Lorelai or Paris and Rory. It felt so much more layered and so much more developed because they didn't need to be pulled apart. They didn't need to have this. They didn't need to make their relationship interesting. And then I kept kind of noticing that in other series as I watched it. I mean, we're talking 10 years ago on Gilmore Girls or even more, but as I watched other shows, I noticed that the relationship that I connected to was less between men and women, or these romantic relationships, and was more between female friendships. And I loved shows that were able to capture how really complex this best friendship between women can be. I've been lucky enough to experience it, and the shows that I always wanted to watch were the ones that involved, that I could relate to this female best friendship. Because, you know, a lot of the time, I don't see my relationship on TV. My relationship my romantic relationship is kind of boring. You know, we've been together for a while. It's not exactly exciting. I mean, that's because we have a lovely, functional relationship. But I did get to see my female friendships because they didn't need to be a dramatic. There didn't need to be a dramatic kind of catalyst for these female friendships.
And Molly, before we get more into particular shows, do you think that this is art imitating life a little bit and not just your life, that maybe for a lot of women there is that love relationship, however that may be, stable or up and down, but there's a stable thing, that rock is that female friendship for a lot of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at a show like Friends, which did male and female platonic relationships and romantic relationships, you know, to varying degrees of success, one of the reasons that show was so good was, and why it's still endorsed today, is that we look at it and we think, OK, okay, in our 20s, in our early 20s, and into our, before we kind of settle down with our partners, our friends become these familial surrogates, right? We're not living with mom and dad anymore, so now we find these meaningful relationships in the people we surround ourselves with, and they're there to help you move, and they're there to when you're sick and things like that. And that, so those relationships are formed, and they continue. I think that the great thing about platonic female relationships is even when you do find your partner, those relationships tend to continue. So yeah, so it's not just me. I think that there are a lot of women who probably relate to this phenomenon of seeing their best friend in these television shows.
So you just mentioned someone who's there when you're sick, and the first example you cite in your piece is from Grey's Anatomy. We're going to listen to a bit about the relationship you mentioned there. It's a scene where Dr. Christina Yang is telling Dr. Meredith Grey why she is listed as her emergency contact.
Anyway, I put your name down. That's why I told you I'm pregnant. You're my person.
I am.
Yeah, you are.
So you're my person. What's so powerful about the relationship between Christina and Meredith?
So one of the things that's so great about Grey's Anatomy is this relationship. And a lot of people said that once McDreamy was killed off last season, they would never watch it again. But for me, once Christina left a couple seasons ago, I was like, I'm done. There's no point to this anymore. This was what kept me there. Christina Yang as a character is very cold. She only relates to very specific people. One of those people is Meredith Grey. Meredith tends to be the little more of a free spirit in the relationship. She's a little bit wackier. She kind of has, she's more emotionally driven than Christina, who is all fear, all kind of practice and rules and laws. And she's very by the book, while Meredith is a little more emotionally driven than that. So really they do have the same dynamics of the great romantic relationships. But one of the things that works so well with them is that when she says, you're my person, what she's really saying is, you're my emergency medical contact. Like, I can't go to the hospital and get this procedure that I need because I need someone to be there just in case something goes wrong. So if something goes wrong and the worst happens, the first person I want them to call is not my mother or my boyfriend or anything like that. It's my best friend because I know that she's going to be there. One of my favorite scenes later in the series, because you're my person comes up a lot, they use it as a refrain throughout to explain this intense love that Meredith and Christina have between each other, is when Christina's trying to explain it to her fiance, and she's saying, she can't figure out a way to express how much she loves Meredith because she's not an emotional person. So the best way she knows how to do that is by saying, if I was gonna murder someone and I needed to hide the body, she's the first person I'd call. So it's kind of this sense of, and you're right, the laugh line in the show, but it's kind of the sense of if you're gonna call one person, there's one person who's gonna bail you out of jail. There's one person you wanna tell how awesome your day was. There's one person who's gonna really pick you up when you're a total mess. You want it to be this one person, and for Christina Yang, it happens to be not her fiance, but it happens to be her best friend. And I think a lot of women, even who have, stable romantic relationships, kind of have that one person outside of their romantic relationship that is the person that they would call if things got really bad.
We're talking about female friendships on the TV with television writer Molly Eichel. She says the most important love relationships on a lot of TV shows, not the romantic interest, not the romantic subplot, the platonic love between two female friends. We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Sam on the line in Mequon. Sam, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Sam?
I just wanted to bring up my favorite pair of female friends on TV right now. It's in the HBO show Game of Thrones, and it's the relationship between the one ruler, Daenerys Targaryen, and her interpreter.
Okay, what do you like about that that relationship? Not a show we go to look for a lot of love sometimes, Sam.
Yeah, it's not, but it's a show that's really intense and has really gripped the minds of the nation. And it's in the relationship, I just find it fascinating how it starts off as her buying her as a slave, essentially, and then her freeing her, and she's her translator and becomes her one of her most trusted advisors and is always there with her and really becomes, like, one of her most important friends that she has.
Sam, thank you so much for bringing that up, Molly. So there's a thing where the character Daenerys Targaryen is dealing with a lot of men in her life, not always romantically, often as enemies, and has this, Sam says, female friend, companion she can rely on.
Yeah, I love that. I didn't even think of that example, but I love that example because, right, here's a woman whose life is a total chaos. She, every time she thinks she has some kind of stability, something terrible happens to her. And really, that's how you think about a lot of these characters. But right, there's one constant in her life, and it's her friend who's with her all the time. And there's, right, she has a romantic partner, and then she has other suitors, and she has other people who she has advisors who kind of come in and out of her life, but the one constant in her life is this woman who she trusts implicitly and will never, you know, and would trust her with her life.
We're talking to Molly Eichel about her piece for the AV Club about female friendship on TV shows. She says they are the best love stories on TV.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the idea that the best love stories on TV are between female friends? What's your favorite female friendship story on television? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with Molly Eichel from the AV Club and the Philadelphia Inquirer. She says the best love stories on TV are between two female friends.
What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. What are your favorite love stories on TV, platonic or romantic? Do you think female friendships are pivotal in movies, too? Who's your favorite pair of female friends in pop culture? Call 800-642-1234. Oh, and does this mean something? Does this reflect something in our culture? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So, Molly, you bring up Sex and the City as an example. Let's take a listen to a clip from that.
I gotta hand it to you, Samantha. Not blowing us off for a guy in your condition. Very classy.
Well, we made a deal ages ago. Men, babies, doesn't matter. We're soulmates.
So, Molly, this is a show, at least on the surface, based on women looking for men, looking for love, looking for sex. So why are the relationships between the female friends so important?
I think that's one of the things that really separated Sex and the City from other shows about, you know, from really anything else that was on at the air. I think that especially after the two movies, which, I was a big fan of the series and hated both of those movies. But one of the things that has been kind of forgotten about Sex and the City, especially as we start talking about sex and especially female sexuality a lot more, the Broad City women are fabulous at this, was how kind of refreshing it was for just a group of women to sit around on television and talk about what they liked and what they didn't like in bed, or what they liked and what they didn't like as men, or in men. But one of the things that I thought about was when kind of revisiting Sex and the City is, here are these women who spend their entire episode chasing a man, being chased by men, having most of their A plot involving men. But when it comes down to it, they always rush to each other at the end. The most fleshed out characters on the show were always women. It was always the four women. The boyfriends were always, especially of Carrie, were always these kind of collection of adjectives and archetypes rather than actual people. And while the women on Sex and the City, while her friends were these kind of fleshed out real human beings, I think you see that in like a lot of different areas of the show. And I'm specifically thinking of when Samantha had cancer, and Samantha she's this woman who isn't anchored down to anyone. And when it came down to needing a person and to go back to the Grey's Anatomy analogy, she called these three other women who, yeah, most of the time they're talking about shoes and men and kind of these superficial things, but over the years they've created, and over the years of the series, they've created just this kind of strong bond that was stronger than any relationship that Carrie or any of the other ones had between a romantic partner.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Melody in Horicon. Melody, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Melody?
I believe that there were two shows that really showed the friendships and platonic love between women. One was Designing Women, and the other was Golden Girls. And it was four, in each case, it was four women with tremendously, vastly different personalities who managed to love each other in spite of their differences and different morals, different religions, different backgrounds.
Melody, thanks so much for bringing that up. And there are a surprising number of Golden Girls fans in the Wisconsin public radio world. We actually almost pulled the sug. Thank you for being
a friend. Thank you for being a friend.
Molly, there are a lot of shows, not just new shows, that have this focus you're talking about.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, like, right, you see the Golden Girls relationship is kind of this progenitor to Sex and the City, of these four women, who are together all the time. And I mean, they live together when it comes to the Golden Girls. And so, right, like they have these kind of minor characters come in and out of their lives. But really what they've done is they've created this kind of new family for themselves. And you see that in shows like, right, Golden Girls, Designing Women. And then on newer shows like Playing House, where there doesn't need to be, they don't need anyone else, right? They don't need a husband or children. They have those things, or they had those things, but they don't really need them so much as they have each other, and they may not be sexually fulfilled, but they're at least emotionally fulfilled. And that's where I really see the important component of this, is that there's a lot of that emotional fulfillment is still there. And you definitely see that in a show like Golden Girls or Designing Women.
Let's go back to the phones, and Pete in Reedfield is on the line. Hi, Pete.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question is wondering whether or not this issue of intimate and really in-depth relationships might be true for buddy films, too, you know, kind of like Sundance and
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah, there you have it. But, you know, I'm just wondering if there isn't something that, you know, not necessarily have a sexual edge to it, but just, you know, you see it in same-sex relationships. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, anything for the dudes out there, Molly?
Well, yeah, I've been looking specifically at TV, and there is certainly this component of male friendship. I just don't think it's as prominent. You know, while I was writing this essay, my boyfriend kept bringing up Scrubs. He kept saying, well, what about Turk and JD?
Yeah.
They have this fantastic relationship as well, that is, you know, where they're constantly they're constantly making fun of the fact that they're closer than to each other than to their romantic partners. It's a running joke throughout the series. And, you know, it's one of those things that, like, yeah, there's that example, and there's a couple other examples of these kind of best guy relationships. I mean, The Odd Couple alone spurned how many different theories in which they're based on this kind of male best friendship. But to me, it's not as prominent, and I don't see it as often, you know, where an entire show is built around this platonic relationship between people. And I think that one of the great things about female friendship is that you can really build an entire series around it.
Talking to Molly Eichel from the AV Club about female friendships on TV, the best love stories on TV. She says, let's check out one more, Parks and Recreation. Here's a scene on the eve of Anne's last day in Pawnee. Leslie, the main character, is saying her goodbye here.
Oh, Anne Perkins, you perfect sunflower. You totally changed me, you know? You taught me how to balance my life, how to be patient, how to be more patient.
Yeah, that's better.
How to throw bureaucratic caution to the wind when it came to Ben. But most importantly, you taught me that I can't pull off a tulip skirt.
It's just not your shape.
A friendship with Leslie Knope, daunting to say the least. What do you make of that one? Definitely a full-on comedy series, but very strong friendships in this one.
So one of the great things that I love about Leslie Knope and Anne Perkins is actually when they fought. So one of my favorite episodes of Parks and Recreation is literally called The Fight. And they, Leslie wants Anne to apply for a job in Pawnee and in government, and Anne's not really entirely sure if she wants to do it or not. And then they kind of passive aggressively nip at each other for a while, and then they both get hammered, and they have this, like, they just have it out at each other. And it's hilarious. They're both very good at playing fake drunk, but really what's so great about it is that it sounds real, right? It's this fight that they're having is really based on the fact that they didn't want to hurt each other's feelings. So they weren't actually saying what they wanted to say to each other. And so it's this kind of great, like, we love each other so much that we don't want to hurt each other, when in fact we're really just hurting each other more. And then they kind of have it out in this, like, hilarious fight in the women's room. And, you know, I, once again, have been lucky enough to experience a lot of these female friendships, and I've certainly been there. I think if you've had that best friend, you've all had that moment of, like, oh, I love her so much, but I also want to murder her a little bit.
And that's a great place to leave it, Molly. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Molly Eichel. She's a contributor for the AV Club and TV writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. She talked about her piece on how female friendships are the greatest love stories on TV. You can find a link to that piece and continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Wisconsin is home to a new artifact of scientific history and African-American history. The UW-Madison announced that it discovered fungus samples in its collection that had been originally collected by the scientist and inventor George Washington Carver over 100 years ago.
The samples are part of the collection at the Wisconsin State Herbarium on the UW-Madison campus. The samples collected by Carver were different kinds of microfungus. That's a fungus that doesn't gather together to form mushrooms.
These tiny fungi can be a big deal in the world. But they're a big deal in agriculture, and that's one of George Washington Carver's main areas of research. Some of these things can cause massive damage. Think of that huge potato blight caused the famine in Ireland in the 19th century.
Well, researchers at the herbarium say the samples may have been forgotten in their cabinets for over 50 years before being rediscovered.
Now, Carver never worked here in Wisconsin. He came close. Born a slave in Missouri, he was the first black student, then the first black faculty member at Iowa State University before his big career at the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama.
I just think it's so cool. I want to know what else is lurking in the corners, fungi or not.
Yeah, I mean, the herbarium, they still have a lot more samples to go through. And then you think of places, you mentioned the Historical Society. Who knows what's lurking in the archives?
We'll cover it when we find it.
Definitely. Well, stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.